Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 16th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be the host today. In the weekly webcast last night, Lyndon LaRouche and his associates presented a very compelling picture of a unique moment in history. It's a moment of great danger. We still have Obama in the White House. We still have the British Empire through Obama threatening wars against Russia and China, destabilizing the Middle East, carrying out policies of genocide in the name of protecting human rights, supporting terrorists in the name of fighting terrorism, and so on. It's a crazy moment in which the explanation for this activity is very simple. Their system is crashing. And so what became clear in the discussion last night, and we'll make it even more clear, I hope, in the program today, is that because of this crisis, we've come to a point where it's now possible to introduce a new system. Not just possible, but it's happening. And therefore, it's a time for big ideas. Those of you who have been participating with us and listening to the LaRouche Show over the years and find it interesting, sometimes you get talking points from it, you've got to go beyond that now. We've got to have a grouping in this country that works with Lyndon LaRouche to bring the United States out from under the collapsing British financial system and into the new arrangements that are centered largely around the BRICS countries. In the United States now, there's growing recognition that the financial system is doomed, and it can't be held up much longer. But the British and Obama crowd is still going for war. They're still trying to intimidate or bluff Russia and China into accepting that there's no way out of the system. But while they've been doing that bluffing, it hasn't worked. I mean, Argentina has called their bluff. Egypt is the latest country to call their bluff. And a new system is being put in place which conforms to the outlines of things that Lyndon LaRouche has been talking about for 40 to 50 years. The idea of the International Development Bank, the idea of a credit policy, the American system economics, and especially a science driver defining every aspect of a new system, especially the question of what is value. And what Mr. LaRouche said last night is that while we don't have all the answers, we know what questions to ask, and a process is in motion. And this process can incorporate all states, including the United States, once we defeat the system of empire. And in that process, we have to take up a discussion of what is of value. What produces value in a society? What economic processes provide a product which is greater than that which is consumed to produce it? And that's where we're seeing the revolution in modern economics taking place. So in today's program, we're going to look at what these new measures of value are. Our guest is going to be Ben Denniston of Lyndon LaRouche's basement team. Ben has been at the forefront of the discussion of new technologies, of the science of applying the principles of the physical universe to the physical economy. And Ben is joining us, having just come from a meeting with Lyndon LaRouche today. So, Ben, welcome to the program, and I'd like to hear from you what you think was the most important message to convey from the meeting with Mr. LaRouche today.
Yeah, sure. Mr. LaRouche opened up with just a very clear, I think, I would call it basically a sobering assessment of kind of trying to put people in the right mind state to handle the scale of the shift that you just laid out, because this is dramatic, this is historic. And what he said is that people have to stop and realize that this whole system that we've been living under is ended, it's done, it's over. And he says what that means is that all the prior opinions and beliefs that people have been clinging to are now gone. He said everything that people have counted on as facts are now no longer true. And he said, you have to recognize that that process is now occurring and you're living in the middle of that process. And in that context, he's been very interested in some reports he's been getting from Jeffrey Steinberg, who has worked with Mr. LaRouche for many decades now, is the counterintelligence chief of the Executive Intelligence Review, Mr. LaRouche's magazine, and has played a key role with Mr. LaRouche going back to the period of the SDI and maintaining a certain level of dialogue and discussion with, you know, what Mr. LaRouche has called the institutions of the presidency of the United States. And Mr. LaRouche has been pointing to the fact that he's getting reports that there is a serious recognition of the failure of this system. And there's now actions being taken or being prepared to be taken to redefine value in the current system and to call the bluff of these fake assets, these fake monetary assets, call the bluff of this whole monetary bubble, and people ready to take action to assign the actual physical values and reassess the actual values of the elements of the financial system.
And Ben, one of the things that I think is important on this, and we've been watching this for a long time at EIR, LaRouche PAC, and so on, but that the scale of leverage right now, that is the volume of debt that exists in the financial system, is growing at a nearly exponential rate. You know, it wasn't that long ago the total derivative valuations crossed over $1 quadrillion. Now it's closing in on $2 quadrillion. And you have, leading economists who are not directly associated with Mr. LaRouche but are paying attention to what he's saying are now pointing out that this is an unsustainable level of debt, which is something that Mr. LaRouche has been saying for a long time. But even more interesting is the series of comments recently from people like Thomas Honig at the FDIC, William White, the former chief economist of the Bank for International Settlements, the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. All of them are saying that the so-called assets on which the leverage is based, that the non-performing assets are growing. So that means you have huge amounts of debt piled on top of assets which are increasingly worthless. And that's why this idea that somehow you can bail it out with a big bazooka of Draghi, that is more quantitative easing, all that's going to do is further weaken the small base on which all this debt is overhanging. So that's part of the recognition that Mr. LaRouche is talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly it. And Jeff Steinberg, in response to Mr. LaRouche kind of opening up, putting this perspective on the table, just said very clearly and simply there's widespread recognition throughout the institutions that we're on the verge of something worse than 2008. Just like you're saying, exactly like you're saying, this is ready to go. And the recognition of that is now there. And the other aspect that Jeff Steinberg reported in response to Mr. LaRouche's remarks today is the fact that what Mr. LaRouche has put forward in terms of a alternative orientation with this science driver program for an advanced fusion economy, for the development of the moon, for the development of fusion resources from the moon is having a very, that there's a lot of excitement and support for that orientation, for the orientation of the United States to join in an international effort in this type of crash program to create, as I think we'll get into, real value.
And Ben, let me ask you, because you do a lot of work with people who are, you might say, institutional figures in the scientific world. Is there a recognition among them of the extent of the decline in work in these areas in the United States, especially over the last 10 years, but over the last 20 to 30 years? I mean, you've been reporting on programs from the 70s and 80s, which have pretty much been shut down. Is it generally acknowledged that that's the case as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, unfortunately, there's, you know, one of the biggest problems is just immense demoralization among even leading scientific layers, because we've been sitting on these things for decades, and they're just not allowed to do what they could be doing to pursue these high technology areas. I mean, I could, a few of us have spoken with some people from the national labs doing work in these areas of fusion and trying to do work in fusion. And I think, you know, one report we got was just kind of encapsulates pretty well the whole picture we're looking at now with regard to this the development of science and the role of science in the economy. And this individual, his experience in the United States has been that he's been involved with and headed two significant fusion programs that were given initial funding. He built up a team. He pulled together a team to be involved in these fusion programs. They built the reactor, the systems to do the experiments. And as soon as they completed building the system and were just about to begin operation, the budget got cut and the whole thing got shut down. So I mean, imagine the effect of that on somebody. You know, they're pulling in new students, they're bringing new students in, they're building a team to begin to do some real fundamental work, and then the program gets shut down, and the team is scattered, and the whole thing just ends up being a waste of time.
You know, and I assume among some of these layers, talking to you and getting this picture that it's not just their program that's shut down, but this is part of a systematic reduction of the physical economy of the United States, part of the collapse of the old system. I assume that they can make the connections, right?
Yeah, to some degree. And in reflecting this same individual reported his experience with China as the exact polar opposite. You know, he had reported that he had been invited to a scientific conference in China. He went there. He said, "What do you want me to present on?" And they said, "Well, what are you working on?" And he said, "Well, I'm working on these various ideas, but I have this program, that program, and I have this, you know, very rough, half thought out idea of an experiment that could be useful, might work, might not work, but I've been thinking about it." And they said, "Why don't you present on that? Present on your idea for this new experiment." And he said, "Well, I haven't really thought it through a whole lot." They said, "That's fine, just come present on it." So he went, he made a presentation on what he was thinking, put his thoughts out there. Again, this is not something that he said had fully thought through or he knew it would work or not. It was just something he was thinking about. He left, went back to the United States, came back a year or a couple years later, and he got there, back to China, and they said, "Come, check this out." And they had built the design that he had proposed. And they said, "What do you want us to do next?" So,
wow.
You know, it just expresses the polar opposite. And so, you know, he also reported, and he said, all this talk about China stealing technology and just, stealing science from the United States, he says that's not true. He says, you know, there was certainly an effort in China to catch up with the world over the past couple decades and absorb as much of the science as possible. And they've been doing that, but they now have a new generation coming on, very young, very intelligent, very smart people that are now using the knowledge that has been absorbed by China to make new breakthroughs, to go into new areas, to do original work. So he said it's a very clear picture that they are serious and they're progressing over there, and it's just the stark contrast, polar opposite of what we've seen in the United States.
Yeah, this discussion you just had on China really gets to this question of the new system that's emerging, that with the collapse of the old, there are countries that refuse to go along with the economic policies of the transatlantic, and in particular, Russia and China played a leadership role. Just from the standpoint of the two systems, give us your sense of the progress that's being made, the astonishingly rapid progress being made by the BRICS countries toward putting together a new system.
Yeah, and that's what makes all this very, very exciting, is that not only is this terrible monetarist system breaking down, but these other nations are actually making serious strides and doing what should be done in creating this alternative system. And this is, you know, centered around major investments in nuclear power, nuclear fission development, major investments in high-speed rail systems, and a serious investment in space exploration and in the development of fusion power. And, you know, with everything, all these elements now breaking out, every week you got a new development. Every day you got a new development. Egypt just announced they want to build themselves with Egyptian labor, with Egyptian companies. They want to build a new Suez Canal, which is an excellent, you know, exciting perspective. They want development. They want new infrastructure projects.
And they want to do it in 1 year.
They want to do it in 1 year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have all these just exciting developments, and you know, Mr. LaRouche has kind of put a certain kind of a certain focus specifically on China's orientation towards the moon as kind of the highest expression of this overall orientation, where China is now in the process of completing its initial phase of a kind of lunar exploratory program with these orbiters they've sent to the moon. They have this rover, this lander and rover they just sent to the moon, and their next step is going to be building towards bringing samples back from the moon, all by these robotic systems.
How far back does this go, the Chinese moon program?
I don't know the whole history on it, but the phase that's going on now goes back to, I think, 2007 or so. I'm certainly not an expert on all the history of how long they've been studying it and what plans they had, and you know, they might have had some earlier programs and earlier studies that I'm not totally familiar with. But the current phase, their lunar exploration program, started, I believe, around 2007.
This is a major focus of the Chinese scientific program.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's part of a whole broad development of their space capabilities, which is very impressive.
I'm not sure if it was you or someone else who reported this the other day, but they really have this thing mapped out so that they're going to be able to begin this process of mining on the moon by the end of this decade. Am I right in that?
Well, that's what they want to orient towards. Yeah, that's definitely the vector and the direction. By 2017, they're going to complete this kind of initial exploratory phase, where they're studying the moon, studying what it's made out of, studying what the concentration of various minerals are, getting kind of the basic scientific understanding needed. But the next step that has been investigated and discussed by some of the leading scientists, including people at the Chinese Academy of Sciences, is to have permanent bases, permanent operations, manned landings. And yeah, absolutely, mining and the development of the resources on the moon for both use on the moon itself, and then specifically there's one thing on the moon that would probably be the only thing that's worth bringing back to Earth. Because all this stuff is, you know, very expensive physically, not just money terms,
sure,
but it's a lot of activity to go to the moon and then to bring something back. That's a huge effort. And so it's been noted that the only real thing that's valuable enough to warrant bringing it back to the Earth is this advanced fusion fuel of helium-3.
Now, Ben, I want to get into that a lot in the second half of
sure.
the program, so we'll use this as a teaser.
Uh-huh.
That if our listeners want to know why Lyndon LaRouche says helium-3 is a miracle, stay tuned, and we'll get to that in just a couple minutes. But I want to stay for a couple of moments on this question of the space program in China.
Yeah.
And also, we did some digging and found that the Russians as well have a similar program, and in fact, I thought one of the most interesting statements was from Dmitry Rogozin, who's the deputy prime minister in charge of science and I think military defense procurement.
Yeah.
But Rogozin said, our program is to go to the moon forever.
Mm-hmm.
And if you contrast that to what the United States did, the incredible effort to get there, and then the shutting down of the program, I think that sort of defines the difference between the old system and the new system.
Absolutely. That's exactly the case. I mean, this is something that we could have done and should have done. You know, Kraft Erika, this great space visionary who was, you know, involved in the original Apollo project and was one of the original real visionaries and scientists developing all the concepts of mankind going out into space. And a lot of what he's developed is either still in use today, or it's going to be the ideas that are going to be used in the later phases. You know, he thought a lot about this, and you know, it's been something that has, we've known some of the basic components about what to do and how to do it, but it's just been sat on under this insane British monetarist system, this zero growth system that's that's fought to suppress and stop these types of major developments and revolutions in mankind's scientific and technological capabilities.
And that's now, especially been the policy under Bush and now Obama.
Absolutely, yeah. That's exactly
shut
it.
Shut everything down.
And, you know, Russia has stated that, yeah, they want to build permanent bases on the moon. They want to, there's factions in Russia that absolutely want to do this. And they want to mine also helium-3 and fusion fuel from the moon. And now we're finally seeing a major global shift led by what China's doing, which can create the conditions where Russia and China and India and other nations can actually work together to do this. You know, it's...
Go ahead.
Say that, you know, that's what makes it so exciting. People in Russia have said, you know, we found reports going back to 2006 that one of the major Russian space companies, Energia, had done, you know, some serious studies and investigations and proposals for how to set up permanent bases on the moon, mine helium-3, bring it back to Earth. You know, they've been looking at this, and they put a lot of this out around 2006. And they, you know, they had said they wanted to do this in 15 years. And they would have been ready if they had the support and backup needed to push that through, to fight to do that. But it's only now that we're seeing this break from this monetary system, the development around the BRICS nations, the increased collaboration between Russia and China. You know, one significant area that we're watching very closely is the cooperation between Russia and China on space technology and on electronics. Russia's now looking to China to get vital, very high-tech, very important electronics for space. You need some very sophisticated electronics to handle the very high radiation environment of space. So there's now a growing collaboration between Russia and China in this vital area, which can be a huge boost and benefit to help Russia achieve their goals in all these areas of lunar development, etc. So it's a lot of things that have been known have been possible, but now we're finally seeing some actual serious motion and orientation towards that, and it's just tremendously exciting. But it means we have to get the United States on board as part of this program.
You're listening to Ben Denniston, who is a leading member of Lyndon LaRouche's so-called basement team, the cutting edge of science in the United States. And we're talking about this idea of two contrasting, contrary, and incommensurable systems. One, a monetarist system of the British Empire, which is collapsing. The other, an emerging series of agreements based on totally, fundamentally different principles of economics. And this, as Lyndon LaRouche has been saying, is his baby. Now, Ben, what you just laid out does get us to the question of the differences between these two systems and where you place value. You know, in the British system with the monetary value, the balanced budget, free trade, deregulation, there's no credit available for these kinds of projects. That's really what happened to our moon mission. Besides the lack of money, the other part of it, what you just identified, is the hatred of real science.
Yeah.
But that does get right to the core of this. You know, China is not the richest country in the world. It's got a growing GDP, but it's also got a lot of poverty in the country. And you often hear in the United States, well, we can't go to the moon because we can't even pave roads, or we can't even run schools, or we can't even do this or that. But it used to be that the argument was that by doing these things, these cutting-edge technology work and research and space exploration and energy, that provides the surplus that enables us to do everything else. And obviously, that's the way the Chinese are looking at it now.
Yeah. You know, I think one very useful expression of this whole shift is what China did around the Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009, where the British were attempting to impose this environmental zero growth policy, including a cap on carbon emissions under the guise of this global warming fraud, which, you know, is increasingly, as it gets colder and colder each year, people are, you know, they're not going along with this this whole global warming scare anymore.
Well, the fraudsters now just call it climate change.
Yeah.
The principal difference is is it man that's destroying the planet, or is there something else at work here?
Right. And they've been using this scare line that mankind is destroying everything to run an imperial policy, to control the development of nations, to stop nations from progressing technologically, to keeping populations low and underdeveloped and impoverished so they could be controlled by this imperial system. And there was a major, major push in 2009 to get an internationally binding system that would determine and limit how much carbon, how much development, how much economic growth nations could actually pursue and build. And China led the way in saying that they were not going to go along with that. And this was such a big deal that the Queen of England herself used the occasion of her address to the entire Commonwealth leadership, the Commonwealth of the British Empire, all the various islands and nations and components of the British Commonwealth, all the heads of these organizations were gathered, and she focused her address to this entire grouping to say, our number one objective is this environmentalist program. We have to ensure that this, and this is on the eve of this Copenhagen summit, we have to ensure that this program goes through, that we have this international agreement to limit the carbon emissions and limit really the growth and the development of these nations through this whole environmentalist scare program. And China led the way in saying no, and they shattered that whole program, and really broke the whole orientation that the British were pushing with the zero growth orientation. But I just think
I think it's clear that the Chinese recognize what Lyndon LaRouche called a long time ago technological apartheid. Mm-hmm. That the policy of the Queen of England and her consort, who would rather be a germ or a disease than a human being, their policy has been save advanced technology for the few and suppress development for the vast majority of mankind. And the Chinese are not just rejecting that, but they're demonstrating the absolute absurdity of that idea.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And they're going, so I think that's all part of what we're seeing now with this break towards, you know, they're as Mr. LaRouche said, they're calling the bluff of the power of this British system, and they're going their own path now.
Well, let's get into helium-3, because this is really at the core of it. I mean, Lyndon LaRouche at a certain point in the last couple of weeks said that this is what we should be organizing people around to understand the miracle of helium-3, as opposed to going through chapter and verse of the war danger, the financial collapse danger. And I think on the whole, this is an extremely exciting perspective. So how would you, you know, if you're in organizing, if you're an average American who wants to change things, how would you present this helium-3 question to give people an understanding of what it's going to take to move the population behind it?
I mean, the key is that fusion is the next stage for mankind. And the best, the most accessible, advanced fusion economy is going to be powered by this helium-3 fuel in particular. But I think the key, I think, goes directly to what you were saying about what is value. How do you know, how do you define real scientific value? Real economic value in a scientific sense. And people have to understand that human creative thought is what generates value. That scientific discovery and technological progress, as Mr. LaRouche said, measured by, which you can measure by energy flux density, that is the source of growth. That is the source of development. That's the essence of what makes the human species the human species.
And to put it in crass economic terms, that's the only way you ever produce a surplus.
Exactly. Absolutely. And the current system is dying because it's in an entropic state, because it's denying any ability for real surplus creation through this type of program.
Well, the only surplus it's creating is a surplus of debt.
Yeah, which means nothing.
Yeah.
It's increasingly worthless, less than worthless. So now we have we've been sitting on the verge of the next technological revolution, the next stage, the next era of mankind, which is a fusion economy, so to speak, a fusion society. Fusion reactions are literally millions of times more powerful than any other form of chemical reaction. And this will allow us to completely revolutionize our relationship to the resource needs, the production needs, the productive capabilities of mankind back here on Earth, but also as we begin to move further and further out into the solar system. You know, I thought, you know, we've been trying to come up in the basement with some pedagogicals and examples and ways to get this across. And one thing I thought was one fun example we developed, I think helps to illustrate what we're talking about. Because you say millions of times more powerful, you know, these are just big numbers. What do they actually mean? And we were looking at the water crisis in the West. And NASA just put out a new study showing that the Colorado River Basin, which I believe the water in the Colorado River supports something like 40 million people. It's a huge component of the Western water system. A huge amount of agriculture, huge amount
of... I think you could even say by multiplier effect more than that, because the food that's produced because of the various irrigation systems that are connected to the Colorado Basin, the Imperial Valley and other places, or actually Southern California. This is a huge component of the green vegetables and fruits consumed in the country.
Yeah. So it's a critical component of the whole economy. And NASA just did a new study, and they found to their alarm that the water in the Colorado Basin is being depleted at an accelerating rate. The flow of the river has reduced over the past decade, so there's less water in the river, which is already problematic, and there's a drought in the whole region, and so people have been increasingly relying on groundwater and pumping out groundwater, and they're pumping out the groundwater much faster than it's replenishing, so it's driving the whole area to disaster. And just for the numbers, it's about seven cubic kilometers of water per year is being lost from the Colorado River Basin. So we were looking at that, and mankind can create water. We can create water. We can create fresh water from ocean water. We can perform desalination. We have these technologies available. And we were looking at it, and we just crunched the numbers, and you can see that it would take one-third of 1 ton of helium-3 per year, which would fit in the bed of a regular pickup truck, to desalinate the water to match the rate of loss in the entire Colorado River Basin. Now that, I think, is amazing to think about. The amount of helium-3 that would fit in the bed of one pickup truck enables mankind to match the needs of an entire river basin of a continent.
I think, Ben, you should complete the example, because you then showed how much coal it would take to accomplish the same thing.
Yeah, right. If we can do desalination with electricity, you can generate electricity a whole number of different ways. But to generate that much electricity with coal would require 67,000 rail cars filled with coal, which would stretch the entire length of the I-5 in California. The Interstate 5, stretching literally from San Diego, from the California-Mexico border, north through the entire state up to the California-Oregon border. A train literally that long, entirely filled with coal, would be required to match the energy provided by one pickup truck worth full of helium-3.
So now let's get down to this question. What is it about helium-3 that makes it ideal for fusion, as opposed to the other forms of deuterium and tritium that otherwise would be used?
It's been referred to as a second-generation fuel, or an advanced fuel. And to put it in simple terms, the reaction from what you get from the fusion reaction of helium-3 and deuterium, and you can fuse helium-3. Which is a special type of helium, and you can fuse that with a special type of hydrogen. And what you get resulting from that is basically a very high temperature plasma that you can completely control with magnetic fields, and you can kind of keep all the energy of the fusion reaction contained and sustained within the fusion plasma itself. Now, this is not the case with so-called first generation fusion fuels.
So it produces the electricity directly.
Yeah, you can produce the electricity directly. The so-called first generation fusion fuels require basically using the heat generated from the reaction to boil water to create steam to spin a turbine. So you're still using kind of a heat cycle effect, which, you know, that'll be part of the process. You know, that's not bad in and of itself, but the potentials of fusion are much higher, and that's the point. And with more advanced fuels, you can go more to what I would say, what the Fusion Energy Foundation used to discuss as kind of a directed energy or a kind of controlled energy approach, where you can more directly use the qualities of the energy of the fusion reaction itself to directly generate electricity without going through a whole secondary heat cycle to produce the electricity.
This is where you talk about efficiencies, the order of magnitude improvements in efficiency.
Yeah, exactly. You get higher efficiencies, and then you also get completely new capabilities, because you can begin to use these controlled plasmas to do new types of processing of materials that you would not be able to do otherwise.
Or you can. I'd like to refer people to the presentation on the New Paradigm Show this last Wednesday of Natalie Lovgren, where she went through really astonishing examples of how, with these new technologies, you're vastly increasing the power available to man, even beyond that which exists on the sun.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so it really is, you know, it's an entire new domain. And, you know, I think one thing, maybe to try and get some of this across, you know, energy doesn't measure work, for example. Just measuring an amount of energy doesn't tell you what that amount of energy can do. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting examples of this. One thing that we've pulled up, some old studies looking at the efficiency in the production of iron, for example, over the history of the United States. And the amount of iron produced per amount of energy has actually continually increased over the history of the United States. So the amount of work that can be accomplished by a unit amount of energy has actually changed, because we've been able to use the energy in more organized forms. What Mr. LaRouche has defined as higher energy flux densities. So we've been able to utilize energy at higher temperatures, at higher densities, higher concentrations, and then we're able to do more work. The average worker is able to produce more goods for society because they're using a higher quality of energy, a higher form of energy. So it's not just an amount of energy generated, but it's these higher qualities, higher capabilities of these more advanced fusion reactions and high energy density lasers like Natalie was going through, or high temperature plasmas, that these things, this whole new domain of this higher energy flux density will completely dramatically upshift the productive capabilities of society. We'll be able to produce more goods, higher quality goods, new types of goods we couldn't even produce now, with less effort of society overall. We'll create more value, create more free energy for the economy as a whole by employing this kind of higher technology platform of fusion.
And that gets to this question of value again.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, let me ask you, is there helium-3 on Earth?
There is very little amounts. Very little amount. You can pull out, if you really put a lot of effort into it, you could pull a tiny amount out of natural gas. There's a certain amount that kind of comes out of the crust of the Earth. What's
the special thing about the moon then? How is it that so much helium-3 is available on the moon?
The sun is spitting it out for billions of years. The sun has actually been producing helium-3 in its in the fusion reactions in the sun, and then it's constantly emitting plasma all from all sides, spewing it out into the solar system, which is a very fascinating process in and of itself, and generates what we call space weather, which is a very interesting topic to get into. But it's part of what it's created, and it's sending out hydrogen, it's sending out regular helium, it's sending out oxygen, it's sending out all kinds of stuff. But some of what it's creating and sending out is this special type of helium, helium-3. And this stuff has been just bombarding the moon, because the moon has no atmosphere and the moon has no magnetic field. So this plasma from the sun, including the helium-3 components, has been just smacking into the surface of the moon and kind of getting trapped in the very fine lunar dust on the surface. So this has built up a huge store, many, many, many times more helium-3 on the surface of the moon than we could ever access on the Earth, because the Earth has a magnetic field and an atmosphere, and this blocks this solar plasma, including the helium-3, from directly impacting the Earth's surface, so it kind of just passes by the Earth and is pushed away by our magnetic field.
Hmm.
So there's a huge...
Now, when we talk about the Chinese preparing to mine the moon, do we have the technologies available now to be able to sift through the fine dust and actually capture the helium-3, or is that something that is still in the process of being developed?
You know, I think there's some open questions there. I mean, I think it's probably safe to assume we're going to run into some new challenges in the process of trying to do this. That's what happens when you try and do anything new. But the basic fundamentals of it is not at all beyond what we can do and what we're already doing on Earth. I don't know. I'm not actually familiar with how much work the Chinese have done and exactly what their plans are from their standpoint for how to extract the helium-3. I know there's people there in the Chinese Academy of Sciences that are looking into this very closely. Perhaps if I read Chinese, I might have access to a little bit more. But there's been scientists in the United States, and as you mentioned, in Russia also, who have looked into this. In the United States, there's a very interesting grouping out of Wisconsin, out of the University of Wisconsin, which is led by a former Apollo astronaut, Harrison Schmitt, who was also a senator, U.S. senator for a certain period of time. And he's hooked up with a top-level fusion scientist by the name of Kolsinski. And they've kind of pioneered, they've created a whole center at the University of Wisconsin to study this. And they've pioneered a lot of studies and worked out a lot of proposals for how to do this. And their studies show that basically you could build tractor-type systems that would scoop, that could move along, scoop up the lunar soil, the lunar dust, the lunar regolith, it's called, relatively easily sift out the very fine powder, and then heat it to a few hundred degrees till it starts to release its gases, and the different gases are released at different temperatures. And all these gases are going to be incredibly useful. Oxygen, you know, being able to produce oxygen on the moon will be incredibly valuable. Because that is air to breathe, and that's also propellant for fuel. So helium-3 is going to be one component of an entire array of useful utilization of the resources that are already there on the moon. You can release helium. You can release helium, and then you have to separate the helium-3 and condense it and put it into a form where you can bring it back to the Earth. So according to their studies, this is stuff that, you know, it's obviously going to be incredibly challenging trying to do it on the moon, but it involves technologies that have been in operation on Earth, you know, in general. Now, obviously, you can't just take a system you have on Earth and put it up on the moon. It's a completely different environment, you know. So there's going to be new challenges. There's going to be new things we have to figure out You know, no one's saying this is going to be just pie in the sky. You're not just going to stick some existing mining equipment on a rocket and shoot it up there and then, you know, just get to work. But the basic...
I think this is what Lynn was talking about when he said we don't have all the answers,
yeah.
But we're going in the right direction. Let me, on this same line of questioning, do you know if at Wisconsin or elsewhere they've developed prototypes for helium-3 fusion reactors?
Yeah, that is something they're working on also in Wisconsin in particular, and there's a few other places that are pursuing this. And this is the other aspect to the challenge that you decided that Mr. LaRouche put out last night. He's saying, you know, we can't predefine exactly how this is all going to occur. And we were talking to him earlier today, and, you know, I made the point that this is a science driver. A science driver is doing something you haven't figured out how to do yet.
Right.
So you can't predefine it, but that's what you want to do, because when you do things you couldn't do before, you enable new capabilities for mankind. You transform mankind's capability for action within the universe.
Well, that's also the benefit of having programs in Russia, the United States, India, European countries, so that you actually have, in some cases, different approaches, different efforts to solve some of these scientific problems, but everyone's collaborating and sharing their discoveries.
Yeah.
I think that's the other step about this move into this new system. Now, before we wrap this thing up, there's one other question I have, which I think is one of the more exciting aspects of this, which is that now we're beginning to look at the possibility for expanding the man's domain in the universe, because with helium-3, as I understand it, that would be one of the components that would be used in fusion-propelled rocketry and travel in space.
Yeah, exactly. That's certainly something that, again, the person I referred to earlier, Croft Erica, he had come to similar conclusions about the power of helium-3 for fusion rockets, fusion propulsion, enabling you to get around the solar system in a serious way for the first time. And again, you know, the kind of the basic simple point of it, again, is this fact that all the products of the fusion reaction are charged particles, so you can kind of direct them and control them and kind of use a magnetic field to push them out the back of your rocket, and kind of you get a direct push from the energy of the fusion reaction itself. You know, and there's varying designs of fusion rockets. We're probably going to have to figure out some more stuff how to make it all work. But that's kind of the general benefit that many people have seen with helium-3 as a fusion, as a propulsion, a fuel for rockets, is that you can use the fusion reaction to kind of directly create a thrust and give you a push, which is not as easy and not as efficient with kind of so-called first-generation fusion fuels. But then again, the key to all this is, again, you're dealing with something that's a million times more energy dense. So you get a million times or millions of times more energy out per weight of your fuel. So the amount of energy you get from 1 pound of helium-3 would require a million pounds of oxygen and hydrogen, for example, if you want to have a chemical reaction. So what this enables you to do is actually, you know, we used some examples of, there's recently a spacecraft that the European Space Agency launched. Well, they launched it 10 years ago, and it just now arrived at a comet 67P. And this is a very exciting mission. It's very interesting. It's the first time we've actually sent a spacecraft and orbited around a comet. It's going to send a lander down onto the surface of the comet, investigate the comet. Certainly going to find some very exciting, interesting things, because we've never done this before. But it's worth pointing out, it took 10 years for this spacecraft to reach the comet. If we had done this, if we have fusion propulsion, you could do something like that in a few weeks. It would take a few weeks, maybe a month, you know, depending how efficient your system is, depending exactly where the comet is, depending when you launch, all these types of things. But you're immediately reducing the travel time in space from years and years down to weeks and months. So it completely revolutionizes our relationship to the inner solar system. And this is critical for defense, if we want to defend against asteroids and comets and, you know, these objects do hit the Earth, they do cause major catastrophes. So we want to be able to defend against these types of things. But more generally, it's enabling mankind to take a new leap to become to begin to develop the whole solar system.
What I was just going to say is that what you're seeing is that the constraints under which we're operating in the present system, which doesn't even enable us to imagine some of these things, once you remove those constraints, you do something very important for mankind, which is that you open totally new areas of investigation. And, you know, when Natalie was discussing this the other day, you could see from the real miniaturization, you know, the so-called marvel of the computer with the miniaturization, people say this is the great breakthrough. We're talking about something much, much smaller with incredible power to fight disease, to do mechanical cutting, metallurgy, and so on. But it does open this whole question, which is at the core of Mr. LaRouche's work, which is the power of the human mind to transform nature. And I think this brings us back to this paper he wrote not too long ago, the short paper on the four basic laws, where he stuck something on there that some people said to me, you know, why are you writing about Glass-Steagall and credit system? And then he has a diversion with Vernadsky. But in fact, that's not a diversion at all, because what we're looking at with this new system that the United States could enter by breaking with the British Empire, we're now unleashing creative powers of man that are magnitudes more than anything we've ever experienced. How the human mind becomes, in fact, the metric of a measure of value.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, I think that's the core issue, and that's, I think Mr. LaRouche certainly sees that as the fundamental point that we have to address. That's what enables all this. Society has to come to a higher realization and recognition of what mankind even is, what the human mind is. The source of value, like you're saying, is solely in the creative powers of the mind. It's not, helium-3 itself is just a gas. It's an inert gas. You know, it doesn't even react with things. It's in and of itself, it's not all that great. In the context of being wielded by mankind coming to master control, the controlled reactions on the incredibly small of the nuclear scale, and enables mankind to become a force of creative development in the entire solar system. So the source of that is the power of the human mind to generate these discoveries, to generate itself higher understanding of how the universe fundamentally works, and then to be able to use that understanding through society to be a creative force in the solar system.
Well, and this is why people should know Mr. LaRouche is so ecstatic, as he's been saying, about this breakthrough that's occurred in the recent weeks, because freeing ourselves from the British Empire does open up a whole new universe. And if you look at something, I was on a radio program this morning where the topic was Ferguson, Missouri, and you had a bunch of angry people, mostly African Americans, talking about the brutality of police departments, which is a problem. It's no question about it. But I brought up on the program, what about the brutality of the stealing of hope from so many, not just African Americans, but young people today? The lack of opportunity, the terrible education they get, that there's no jobs for them. And what we're talking about in this program is going to require hundreds of thousands of people going into areas in science and engineering, taking people who today can't hold a job and giving them skills, for example, with water projects and high-speed rail. And you know, the example of Egypt, where they're going to have 15,000 new jobs immediately in building this new canal. So I think what we're looking at is something that goes far beyond what the average person can think about. And you've got to imagine it. You've got to think about what it is that this capability opens for mankind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it goes, and I would also add, it changes the value of people's work, even if they're not doing something different. You know, if you have people who are farmers, or people who are steel workers, or people, you know, even doing the same job of producing
a plumber,
right? Exactly,
yeah,
doing the same,
example.
Yeah, right, doing the same production of food for society. If they're doing it in a context where they're contributing to the creation of an entire new fusion economy for mankind, the value of their work is fundamentally different. It's not the same. You might think they're doing the same thing, but they're participating in a process of creating an entire new stage of humanity that's going to be able to support, you know, an order of magnitude more people at greater living standards, at greater comforts and being able to supply all the needs of society. So the value, the contribution of their work is fundamentally different because it's actually part of the process of creating this entire new stage. So I think
it's interesting that in China now, where they had this problem for a while of the so-called overpopulation, they had the one child per family policy, they're rethinking this because they're beginning to realize that 1.2 billion people is not enough once you move into this new realm of physical economy.
Yeah, the people are our resource. People are the point and the source of value in society.
And that certainly is a change from where we are in Obama world, where you're expendable. And we see that everywhere in the world where Obama has a reach, where the British Empire runs things. Well, Ben, we just have a couple minutes left, and we've really covered a lot. Is there anything in particular you want to either add or just reemphasize, reiterate for people who want to know how to take these ideas out and organize? Go ahead. Whatever.
Yeah, I think the main point is that it's on us to do this right now. I mean, there's an incredible vacuum of leadership in the United States, and we've seen the crumbling of Obama. We're seeing the crumbling of this, the control of this Wall Street London financial system. We're seeing the emergence of a new orientation by the majority of the world centered around China, Russia, and India. But the big question mark in this whole process is getting the United States on board with this program. And that is our responsibility. That's what we have to do. We have to build the constituency, we have to build the support base, and we have to lead the United States to go along and join China, join Russia, join India in this science driver, pro-growth orientation. And people who are listening to this show should feel an immense sense of personal responsibility to make that happen. This is on the shoulders of Mr. LaRouche and our movement, because we have uniquely represented for decades the fight for exactly this type of shift. And now the whole situation is opening up, and we need to make sure we step forward with a clear voice and a clear orientation to make this happen in the United States.
And for it to happen, we do have to get rid of Barack Obama from the White House. He's still there as the leading impediment to this, as a representative of the dying British Empire. So, Ben, I want to thank you for being on the program today. This is very inspiring material. We are putting something out, I understand. Is it going to be a 21st Century Magazine, or how will people have access to some of this written reports that are coming out of the basement?
Yeah, we're kind of have an ongoing series of articles we're putting out, filling out the picture on this. And there's a page on the LaRouche Pack website, which I believe is entitled China's Lunar Helium 3 Orientation or something to that effect. And there we've been posting articles that we've been writing about China's activity, about Helium 3, about lunar development. We've also posted a lot of classes that we've done to LaRouche Pack activists, to different regional offices around the country, on the Wednesday weekly report show. So, and yeah, we were working towards compiling a selection of that material and putting it together kind of as a single package, a single report that can be downloaded and printed off and circulated. We're continuing
to do that.
So
there's no excuse for someone to say they don't know about this. If you found this intriguing, exciting, inspirational, roll up your sleeves and do some work. Go on the LaRouche Pack site. Some of this is also an executive intelligence review. So, Ben, we're pretty much out of time. Thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have someone from the basement back, I'm sure, within the next few weeks, because we want to keep this process updated for our listeners. So, Ben, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Harley.
And that will do it for this edition of The LaRouche Show. Thanks for joining us. Tell your friends, get your friends on this program also, and join us next Saturday at 3 p.m. for the next LaRouche Show.